Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and this is an emergency podcast of sorts. We're reacting to a significant recent development in the House Democrats' impeachment inquiry. So on Tuesday, the senior U.S. diplomat to Ukraine, William Taylor, testified that President Trump made military aid to Ukraine contingent on the president of Ukraine publicly announcing investigations into the Bidens and the 2016 election. Taylor's testimony appears at odds with what was made public from U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland's testimony last week. Sondland said that Trump told him there was no quid pro quo, but on Tuesday, Taylor testified that Sondland told him that a White House meeting and military aid were dependent on Ukrainian investigations. So here with me to discuss what all this means, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Going well, Galen.
Also with us is senior politics writer, Claire Malone.
Hey, Galen. I'm good.
Good to see you. And managing editor Micah Cohen, how are you?
Very nice.
We'll start off quite bluntly. Claire, is this the most serious development in the impeachment inquiry since President Trump released that summary of his call with President Zelensky?
I think it is certainly significant. I mean, I think the first event was probably like the most significant in some ways, but this opening statement is a 15-page detailed accounting of basically a couple of months of diplomacy. And Taylor describes what he calls the official and unofficial channels of Ukraine policy or something to that effect, and basically says that, yes, it was his understanding that the aid was conditioned upon these investigations being made. And he's very detailed about the conversations, when things happened, what calls he was excluded from, things like that. It really takes you into the art of State Department cable writing, right? This is like, if you are a career diplomat, this is what you do for a living. You describe these events and analyze them for the people back home in D.C. And that's what this guy did.
So to be clear, we don't have his full testimony. We just have his opening statement. But are there any key excerpts or revelations from that opening statement that you think are important to recognize?
The part where he says there was a quid pro quo? You mean that part?
Well, so like when we first got this, I was like dropping screenshots of what I thought were standout parts in Slack. And then eventually I just had to stop because there was 20 standout parts. Before we get into specific parts, what I would say is the pushback on this has been and will be there is no firsthand account from Taylor of an interaction with President Trump in which Trump makes the quid pro quo explicit. And that's true. Actually, this is maybe best thought of as just like a super well-sourced news report on what went down here, right?
Well, he also describes firsthand interactions he has with other people.
With Sondland, yeah.
Absolutely.
As a principal.
Sondland's a principal. He's not Trump, though.
So this is what he says. He said, Ambassador Sondland told me that President Trump had told him that he wants President Zelensky to state publicly that Ukraine will investigate Burisma and alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. That's a direct quote from his opening statement. And then he goes on to say, Ambassador Sondland also told me that he now recognized that he had made a mistake by earlier telling the Ukraine officials to whom he spoke that a White House meeting with President Zelensky was dependent on a public announcement of investigations. In fact, Ambassador Sondland said, everything was dependent on such an announcement, including security assistance.
It's sort of a high-stakes game of telephone, but Taylor is pretty emphatic that he had this conversation with Sondland. But no, I know what you mean, Micah, though.
Yeah, absolutely. So to me, the significance of this is really that it makes more likely and seems to indicate that sort of the worst case version of this for Trump, which I think the worst case version for Trump is that military aid was involved in a quid pro quo, as opposed to a presidential meeting, as opposed to other stuff, right? The significance of this is that this makes that seem more realistic, and maybe that happened, but it is still one step removed, right? It's like Sondland told me that President Trump said to him.
Do you think that in order for Democrats to prove a quid pro quo, they need somebody to recount a conversation that they had with President Trump in which he says, let's withhold military aid until there is this public announcement by President Zelensky?
No, like I think there's a ridiculous amount of bar moving here. The evidence against Trump is incredibly damaging already, including like the stuff that the White House has released in its kind of official version of events. And it just kind of tends to confirm that.
There is some sense, though, that the Intelligence Committee will want Sondland to testify again, given Taylor's testimony that he had a conversation with Sondland during which Sondland said, yeah, I talked to Trump and the military aid is conditioned on doing these investigations.
Sure. And look, we don't know everything Sondland testified to.
Correct. Yes.
So it's possible there's stuff in there that just hasn't come out yet. But Nate, I think that saying, oh, we all, you know, the evidence was already damning underplays the extent to which this provides a roadmap for Democratic investigators into the worst case for this. Like, I guess I do subscribe to the idea that if military aid was part of the quid pro quo, that is a stronger impeachment case politically for Democrats than if it was a White House meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I take Nate's point that the White House released the quote-unquote transcript, not a real transcript, the memo, the memorandum of a pretty damning interaction with a foreign leader. But there is, to me, there's some sense of just impeachment is a momentous decision by the Congress, by the American public. And there's almost this like, instead of getting a quickie wedding, we're going to do a big do-up affair, white tie, right? And we do all the steps to get there. They do all the investigations. They kind of want to leave no stone unturned. You know, it's a little bit like Caesar's wife must be above reproach. If we're going to throw the country into this kind of chaos, let's make sure that we've investigated every avenue. And I do think that the idea, I mean, a little preview, I'm going to be writing about this week for my Spin Cycle column on the lens through which we see impeachment. But I do think there's something interesting about the way that Democrats are keeping these hearings closed door, secret, right? There's an idea of we want to compile a narrative and then send it out to the public. Now, Republicans are obviously pushing back on this very hard. You saw this morning 30 House Republicans in a sort of ridiculous stunt try to storm the secure testimony room. The police had to do like a security sweep because they brought their cell phones in, which is a big no-no. But they're basically saying these hearings are unconstitutional. The president is being denied due process. So there's this kind of interesting narrative about the secrecy of the proceedings.
It's also stupid because like sooner or later, obviously, Democrats are going to want to make this testimony public, particularly Taylor, who obviously have not seen the testimony, but from reading it, it's composed in a way that is trying to drive a quite coherent narrative, and there seem to be people, including the whistleblower, who like also kind of compose something, whether the whistleblower testifies publicly or not, is TBD, obviously. But like, there are people who think, hey, this is kind of a fairly unambiguous open and shut case, and I think it's going to be different potentially than the Mueller testimony. You also have people, I mean, you know, there was one Democrat who on MSNBC last night was talking about whether Sondland had perjured himself and whether that could become a potential problem for him. So you're going to have people freak out and plead the fifth. You're going to have people who flip, and you're going to have all types of things that make it interesting. And it's just the extent to which kind of things are really caving in and kind of the semi-official position at times of the White House has now become, well, we did it, but so what? Right.
Well, I have the White House statement from yesterday in front of me. It's, quote, President Trump has done nothing wrong. This is a coordinated smear campaign from far-left lawmakers and radical unelected bureaucrats raging war on the Constitution. There was no quid pro quo. That was the statement yesterday.
That's all that's really left to them. You know, they have, they have at times floated out other talking points as part of their defense. You know, for a little bit there was Ukraine didn't even know there was a freeze on the military aid. So how could it be part of a quid pro quo? And then the Times is out with reporting today that, no, actually, Ukraine officials knew all about the freeze in August.
And I will say that Taylor's testimony does also indicate that basically one of the chief counselors to the president of Ukraine had conversations prior to that meeting that with U.S. officials that indicated that he understood that military aid was involved with all of this. The White House is, scraping the bottom with the idea that a constitutionally outlined process, impeachment, is unconstitutional. I mean, I think it's like that's to me is sort of it's like laughable on its face. And yet we live in a time when it is a decent line to put out to your base, although I'm not sure you're winning hearts and minds of like those on the fence Republican voters with that defense.
I want to ask a little more about the specifics of the Democrats' investigation, but first, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper Mattress. Say hello to Casper, the sleep company with outrageously comfortable products that help everyone sleep and live better. With over 50,000 five-star reviews, it's the most loved and trusted sleep company. So don't lose sleep over finding the perfect bed. The four layers of premium foam are designed to provide pressure relief for all-night comfort. With bedding, bed frames, and even Glow, a magical light for better sleep, Casper has everything you need to complete your dream bedroom. Need time to decide? Sleep on it. Casper mattress comes with a 100-night risk-free trial. Rest easy with free shipping and free returns. Get the mattress of your dreams today. Go to casper.com/politics and use code politics for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's casper.com/politics, code politics, to get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. See casper.com/terms. Customer experience and product reviews are based on casper.com, authorized retailer sites, and Google. We're back, and Claire, you were just talking about the White House criticizing Democrats for pursuing this unconstitutional process, which is outlined in the Constitution as within the purview of House duties. Why aren't Democrats doing this part of the investigation out in public and just do away with that kind of criticism?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is you don't want witnesses to sort of line up their testimony based on, you know, if they know what previous witnesses have testified, then they can sort of make sure it all syncs up. Point number two is, and Claire was getting at this earlier, I think there is a benefit for Democrats if impeachment has a few acts. I mean, we've all touched on this before. But if all this happened at once, which it kind of did, like to the point Nate made earlier, day two of this story, we had a smoking gun, so to speak, for at least one part of it. But I think in order to build a coalition, a bipartisan coalition behind impeaching and removing Trump, you need a few stages between the start and the end. It's just like human nature to want that.
From a public opinion standpoint, right. We talked on Monday about, hey, have things kind of stalled out a bit or not? If you look at the polling, the clearest case for things have not stalled out is the numbers among independents, which seem like they're getting worse for Trump. And also, by the way, I mean, the whole thing about Trump's approval ratings is they have been within such a narrow range that, like, we interpret 41% is really different than 42% from 43%. But for what it's worth, his approval ratings are now the worst they've been since the shutdown and are tracking. I'd like to see a couple more polls about that. I'm sure there will be. There are lots of polls in the field this week. But, like, this is not going poorly for Democrats at the very least.
Sure.
The other thing I would just say about Democrats doing at least the first stage of this behind closed doors is, one, there's nothing really that unusual about that. Like, sure, during Watergate, there was public testimony. There was also behind closed doors testimony.
There was a grand jury, and right. A grand jury is always in private.
Yeah.
No, so the grand jury was private. But even in Congress, some of those interviews, like, they would often actually – so, like, the guy who revealed the White House taping system, Alexander Butterfield, he originally revealed that taping system in testimony behind closed doors, and then they later in the day, I think same day, had a public version of that testimony. So there's nothing that weird about it. The other thing is it has this destabilizing effect on Trump and the White House, right? So they don't really know, I'm sure they know more than we do, but they don't have a great sense for what Democrats yeah. have and don't have. And so they're, and we've seen this, their defense on this is all over the place.
It's interesting. So last week I talked to a crisis PR expert, and he said something interesting, which was, he said, the White House is really good at winning the day. They're really good at, like, responding to the day's comments and all that stuff. And so that's interesting, Micah, where you say, because they are kind of flying blind on some sense about what is happening in detail and minutia in these hearings, they're forced to rely on the sort of blanket, this is unconstitutional. And I think it is to Democrats' benefit to say, really, to my instinct is they're constructing the narrative behind the scenes. We saw the Mueller report. I mean, it didn't end up being the, I don't know, dramatic thing that people necessarily thought would happen. But it was, at the very end of the day, the sort of comprehensive, here's what we found kind of thing. And I do have a sense that, like, Pelosi and Schiff want things to be clean and controlled, and frankly, probably don't want some of their members who have been calling for impeachment for 2 years. I can think of, like, you know, Maxine Waters has been calling for impeachment yeah. for a really long time. There are some people who I think could get out over their skis and push things, the rhetoric, further than, say, Pelosi and Schiff want to, because they want to give the appearance, particularly since some of their members have put their asses on the line in these competitive districts, of due process.
No, and that's why you know, catering to those more cautious, more moderate members is super important. And also why the Taylor testimony is so significant is a lot of those members seem to be drawing more of a line around the military aid as part of the quid pro quo. And, you know, like the op-ed that came out originally, that was a big part of that. So I think the kind of national security part of this story is more important to those members than like the just blanket pro-impeachment.
Yeah. To your point about national security, Taylor's testimony, that opening statement, laid out in terms that haven't been discussed so much in the press the national security significance of Ukraine in Eastern Europe and as pertains to Russia.
Spheres of influence.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did he have to say about that?
I mean, he's a guy who is basically making the argument that Ukraine is the, you know, using the Cold War thing of spheres of influence, Ukraine could either be the ally and friend and influential partner of the United States, or it could be Russia's pawn and entree into European politics more deeply. And the idea that they are fighting a war against Russia, that they are fighting corruption things. I mean, basically what I get a sense of out of all of these kind of leaked testimony things is the president of Ukraine is basically in this impossible position in many ways where he's a guy who's kind of doing what America wants, right? He's appointing the anti-corruption prosecutors. He's kind of doing the small d democratic reforms in this country that, yes, does have a history of Soviet influence. But on the other hand, he wants to keep on the good side of Trump and keep his military aid. And so basically Ukraine is positioned, and I think this is probably right, as it's a lot of people are Russian speaking or the dialect, right? Like it is certainly a country where if we see Russia as the United States as a real threat, as like a geopolitical foe, which I think we do, then Ukraine, which is a big country, there's oil pipeline stuff going on there. There's energy interests. There is an interest in the U.S. keeping Ukraine Western, not Russian tilting.
Yeah, he reiterates over and over again, it should be the bipartisan policy of the United States, right, to be pro-Ukraine.
No, and it largely has been outside of the White House. And the more stakes attached to the military aid, so the military aid is to help Ukraine in its ongoing war against Russia,
right?
Like, it's not like these are like, middling stakes here. So the more stakes attached to that side of things, the more, I think, weight attached to any transgressions on Trump's part.
And we should say that, like, Taylor's testimony includes the fact that, like, Republican Senator Ron Johnson reassured Ukrainians that the United States had an interest in providing them with military aid, right? Like, Republicans behind the scene were saying, we're with you, the aid should go to you, that kind of thing.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
And it seems like we all kind of think the White House, Trump and the White House, are in a really bad way here. Do they have a good course of action available to them? A good defense available to them?
The White House?
The what house?
The what White House? White House?
Which house? The White House.
The Greenhouse. That's a real word too. I mean, the complicating factor is that, like, if you make the defense that this is bad, but it's not impeachable, which may be their best defense against impeachment, there are a small number of Americans who do feel that, like, hey, we're voting in a year, so no need to impeach, right? The problem is you're kind of conceding that Trump is a pretty malicious actor when he's also on the ballot for reelection.
And so there's strong political incentives not to do that for Republicans, is what you're saying?
Yeah. Could win impeachment and lose the election.
I mean, it's hard. Look, all we know is there's a trajectory where things seem to perpetually get worse for Trump. And there's a question of, like, how much further that can go before we start to talk about unthinkable things like him in some way, shape, or form, like not being the Republican nominee. You know, I mean, if it was someone who was like, I don't want to speculate, but, like, you know, if it was someone who was like maybe a little bit more,
man, he really wants to speculate,
rational, right? Then maybe you could say, okay, maybe you should not run for reelection. You should ride out in the sunset, and maybe we have an agreement that, like, you won't be prosecuted after you leave office. Maybe we can kind of get some buy-in on that, right? But you can say, I made America great in my first term, and the economy is great, and my buddy Mike Pence or my friend Nikki Haley is going to
take it from
here. Re-election. I don't know.
At this point, though, and I was watching clips from Fox last night. Matt Gaetz, the representative from Florida, was on talking to Lou Dobbs, and he was basically turning it into a he said, right? Sondland said explicitly Donald Trump told him there was no quid pro quo. So is...
And Taylor's saying the opposite.
I don't...
Is this now a he said, or is that being too generous to the situation?
I think it's too generous. And I think if that's their strategy, then they're in for a word of hurt. There's just too many... I mean, Taylor's testimony makes clear there were a lot of people involved here.
An OMB person who says, my bosses said it's direct from the White House that we cannot release the aid. You have, I mean, John Bolton...
Bolton
calling it a drug deal.
No, and then, you know, Pence was in some of these meetings.
Yeah, like, it's not a little bit of an issue.
Right.
It's not just, I mean, it truly is. It's basically like everyone against Sondland.
No, exactly. But again, we still don't know what Sondland said.
Yes, correct.
Who knows?
That's stipulated.
The best defense I've heard from the White House, and I'm stealing a point that Amelia Thompson DeVoe made in our Slack channel, but the best defense, it's not a good defense, but at least it's like a workable defense, is like they should just sort of cop to everything but say, I was concerned about corruption. This was all as part of a effort to fight corruption. Because as Amelia pointed out, motive is really hard to prove, right? Or it's much harder to prove than, you know, was the military aid withheld or not, right? So once you get into motive, it's just you got a little more room to maneuver.
And you have heard that somewhat from Republicans,
yeah,
right?
Said
I mean, really? They think Trump's a corruption fighter?
No, of course.
Well, I mean, he did run on Drain the Swamp.
Look,
that follows.
Talking about politics here. We're not talking about what seems credulous to Nate Silver.
They have a lot of defenses.
Boom.
So there are roughly 41% of voters approve of Trump, declining by a point or so. Of those, maybe 26% approve strongly. They have lots of defenses that the 26% will believe, and many that the 41% will believe. But the problem is the other 59% are building support for impeachment. And, I mean, Trump, unless the polls are way off, needs to get above 41% to have a good shot at reelection, right? Numbers retreating to his overall approval rating, especially when his approval rating is declining on impeachment, which may be where we're headed, is not good for Trump.
All right, so looking a little bit down the pike at this point, given the way that facts are unfurling, should Democrats want a vote on impeachment soon? Or is it in their interest to drag things out? What should their strategy be from here forward?
I don't think they need to have it right away. I think they should do their initial round of behind the closed doors testimony and then aim to have an impeachment vote, you know, like a little bit before Thanksgiving or something.
That's kind like of soon. That's kind of soon, right?
Yeah.
For what it's worth, the conventional wisdom, if you look at prediction markets, which we talk about too much on this show, they have the overall chance of President Trump in being impeached increasing, but the chance of it happening this year decreasing. I mean, there's like not really a perfect time, right? You know, we think about our own editorial calendar because you're going to have the holidays. You're going to have the early stage of the primaries, right? It's going to, you know.
Yeah,
they don't want to be doing it while it's – if February is the first
set
of primaries, you want to get it done by before then.
And they also want to get it done in time for there to be a trial in the Senate before February as well, you'd think.
I think they have to aim for like mid to late November, December, somewhere in there.
Little holiday cheer, figgy pudding and impeachment.
All right, we will leave it there. Nate, thank you.
Thank you.
Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
Micah, thank you.
My pleasure.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.